Hey, welcome to the Morning Mic Check. I'm Pat Brown here with Mike Metzger. Mike and I have known each other for a while now. I first met him around 2010, and he's become one of the key mentors in my life. Over the years, we've had countless conversations, and in almost every one, I've walked away having discovered something new. Mike has this unique ability where he can reframe a conversation, and you begin to discover a deeper reality around you. It's a bit like Alice tumbling down the rabbit hole. I'm releasing these conversations as an invitation to follow me as I go down that rabbit hole. Well, good morning, Mike.
Good morning.
I have a lot of thoughts this morning. A lot of them are around sort of maybe their company level or even specifically for me, team level. I know we've talked in the past about some things of values and missions and company culture. And there's a lot going on in my company in terms of trying to facilitate those for my department, but also at my team level and trying to instill culture, looking at values and missions and a bunch of, you know, other things that are all kind of in that category related. So I wanted to pick your brain a little bit about, are those things effective? Are they valuable for a team to do, or are there other things that are maybe something out of the box or a little bit closer to being effective in terms of leading both a team and an organizational level?
Sure. Well, we'll probably upset a few apple carts this morning for some for business leaders, and but what the heck, this is our podcast; they can do theirs. Yeah, the whole fact that I didn't get very far with a couple of companies in the past where I tried to suggest to them that, two ways to think of it. Dennis Bakke, who was a co-founder of AES, one of the world's largest energy distribution companies, wrote a little book called Joy at Work. But he gave a talk in 1991. It was called Values Don't Work in Business. So we'll come back to that and remember that in a moment. But he had a pretty intriguing little talk. By the way, that company was on the cover of Business Week many years ago. It was an exceptional company to work for. And if you were to read the article or just Google the you could probably find the talk "Values Don't Work in Business," or if not, we'll make it available to you, listeners, if anyone wants to read it. It's pretty astonishing what they did in this company. By the way, they had no management levels. They had no HR department. They had no. Let's talk about that just for a moment. When you listen to when you read the talk, Values Don't Work in Business, he said, we started AES to see if we could wipe out 19th century understandings of human nature. Well, that makes for, I'm sure that investor money was no problem to come up with. I mean, they understood, they saw that meeting a need in society is a reason to start a good business. But what distinguishes them, if you read the Business Week article, is how they understood human nature. And if I were to summarize it, it'd be this way. He said, we believe individuals are thinking, creative, and responsible. Now, Bakke is a follower of Christ. He draws all that from the Bible. Yet they translated all the Bible language into boardroom language so that it wasn't a Christian company. It was just a good company, and not just a good company. I mean, it was a terrifically good company. But one of the things they also understood in that is that, it doesn't come out in the article, but if you read between the lines, Bakke understands that the Bible says you don't manage people. Now, there is an idea that you steward and manage a household. I get that. That's in a family. But the Bible basically says we manage animals, assets, and appetites. Animals, assets, like talents, and our appetites, that is our bodily habits, and those are called spiritual disciplines. And he rightly understood the whole idea of management comes out of Frederick Winslow Taylor. It originates with Taylor. And Taylor, as you may or may not remember, is famous at U.S. Steel for the pig iron experiments, where he treated the workers, mostly Hungarians, as oxen, animals. And he did these studies. Was there a way to increase the efficiency of workers at U.S. Steel? And so, long story short, is the experiment, which just it recorded movements down to the very micro movement to say, can we improve here? Can we improve here? Can we improve here? First of all, it took all the joy right out of work. And second, eventually turned out to be a miserable failure. But Taylor, undeterred, was still looking for a place to propagate his newfound ideas about what he called scientific management. That's why Frederick Winslow Taylor is called the father of scientific management. He eventually ends up at Harvard Business School, the new Harvard Business School, which was looking for a theory or a model that would demarcate it. And so that became the school that taught modern management, scientific management. Now, by the way, the reason I'm going to some lengths in this is that's how you change the world in significant ways. You get center institutions, they're called. That is, if you imagine, this is how societies change. They, not primarily bottom up or top down, but if you are this summer out at a pond, throw a rock in the center of the pond and watch the ripples go out. Those center ripples are what would be called center or more influential institutions, and then it ripples out. And the church is often called way out on the edge, more a receiver of the ripples than a creator of the ripples. And so Taylor, by being at Harvard Business School, that's considered a center institution. And the people have written about this, the scholars will say it's just a handful of center institutions. One person, for example, years ago joked that we live in a TGIF world, Twitter, Google, iPhone, Facebook, and that they have disproportionate influence on shaping the cultures that we swim in. So Taylor's at Harvard Business School, and that's where management comes from. Now, Bakke is one of the few Christians I've ever met, or few business leaders, who understood the origins of management. And when you read this little article in the Business Week or read the little talk, Values Don't Work in Business, you'll read that they had no layers of management. So they didn't have, as he jokes, we didn't have this HR department that determined how much vacation you can take and the requisition forms you have to fill out and where you will work and so on and so forth. So all that to say, it's a fascinating little talk he gives, but he talks also about, now, they did actually call them values, and we're going to get to that in a moment. But the power in his talk is at one time at a large business meeting, many of the people came up and they said, we really love working here because these values really work. And Bakke turned to co-founder Roger Sant, who they co-created the company. And he said, Roger, we've made a terrible mistake. He said, we don't do these things because they work. We do them because they're right.
Huh.
And so they said, we've got to start all over again. So first of all, one of the difficulties in America, and Pat, you're going to have in your company, is Americans are what Richard Hofstadter called, he said, they're not practical and they're not impractical. They're extra practical. And I saw this recently with a group. I was facilitating a meeting over Zoom, and you could tell the toes, you could hear the toes start tapping in the feet because they're going, come on, come on, come on, come on, come on, get what's, well, let's make it practical. Let's make it practical. And extra practical people are actually practically useless because they don't take the time to go, All right, you want to instill these values. Where the heck do we even get the notion of values? How do we know values are good? How do we know they're effective? I don't care. Just come on. Call them gum chomping, extra practical people. And they are rife through business. They're rife through almost every organization in America. So we're going to talk a bit about values. But anyway, that's Dennis Bakke. Values don't work. So he actually does use the word, but then he also notes they really don't work, because that's what people are going to be drawn to. They work. As I often joke, torture works. I don't think we'd call it good, but it does work. So you wanted to talk about what would be an effective, high-performing business environment or culture? So let's first at least break down a few things here. And of course, for listeners who go, here we go again on language. Yeah, I know. God created by wise words. We're supposed to be made in his image. We're supposed to govern rightly by properly naming things. Let's get practical. Okay, you practical idiot. I'm kidding. By the way, the reason we call them idiot, we're never supposed to call someone a moron. Remember, Jesus said, if you call someone moros, you're guilty of the lake of fire. But to call someone an idiot, the reason idiot, it comes from the idea that that's an individualist, idios, idiot. Is someone who just looks at everything through their own lens. It's just what I think. It's the person who uses the word I all the time. Well, I. It's individualism. An individualist is an idiot because they, and then they revel in their idiosyncrasies, it's called. That is, hey, here's what's unique to me. Here's my mirror. Here's my reality. Here's what those people are idiots. And it's not any more offensive to call them that, as Jesus calls some people whitewashed tombs, which is a hypocrite, something different on the inside than the outside. And he doesn't say, hey, I don't mean to offend your sensibilities here, but you're whitewashed tombs. No, he just says, you're a whitewashed tomb. And that's a way to cut to the chase scene. All right. So for those of you who are wondering, let's start first of all with culture. Now, because this word, I often think, dang, I wish it hadn't become so popular some 40, 50 years ago. And about 30 years ago, and a lot of Western Christianity. Pat, when you think of culture, what do you think of?
By default, probably before adding my Metzger lens, I'm thinking of what does it feel like to be part of this organization? What do people do in this company? Really, what are the values they've defined, and how do they live those out? How do people talk to each other? Some of those things.
Good. And just one qualification. It's not how Metzger defines it, because who gives a flying flip how Metzger defines things? I would think it's how people who are a whole lot smarter than we are and have given this a great deal more thought. We're just piggybacking here. We are translating it, putting it into everyday language. So here's a tip off. I've often said this when I lead company meetings and they do mission statements and values and what have you. And I go, hey, do you do this at home with your spouse?
I'm sure some of them do.
Oh, and then they're the ones in counseling. They always laugh and say, no, of course not. So why not? That tells you, first of all, we almost plug in a different brain when we go to work. We would never inflict most of this on our spouse, on our kids. We don't slap mission statements on the wall. So you can tell there's either something dehumanizing about one or the other. I happen to think it's often in business. Second, we forget that up until 200 years ago, most businesses came out of the home. So you didn't have all this all this talk about cultures and instilling culture. So I still think one of the easiest ways to understand culture is was given in the famous Occidental commencement address, David Foster Wallace. You can Google that. And he begins with the story of two fish swimming up the stream. An old fish swims by. How's the water, boys? Later on, further down the stream, one little fish looks at the other and says, what the hell is water? Cultures are the waters that are going through your gills right now. Cultures are the air you breathe, the things you taste and touch and feel, really the things you hardly give any thought to. That's why in the Old Testament and the New, cultures are defined or depicted as worn paths. That is, when you used to commute to work, Pat, it was the route you took, such that when you got up in the morning and got in your car, you didn't give it twice thought. You didn't pull out Google Maps and, how am I getting to work today? And you just kind of drove and hardly even thought about it. You could think about other things because your wheels got in this rut, and off you went, you arrived at work. So first of all, cultures are worn paths. So what most companies don't appreciate is, first of all, you already have a culture. You have cultures. So when they say we're going to build a culture, create a culture, instill a culture, that's like, now let's go back to the two fish. And so we live outside of Washington, Pat and I, we're in Maryland. And we're going to go to those fish in Anacostia, and we're going to instill new water. We're going to apply some new water. We're going to have them engage this water, like engage culture. I love that phrase. We're going to engage culture. Couple things to note. First of all, if you bump into a fish in the Anacostia, and for listeners, if you're not familiar with the Anacostia, it's not a river you swim in. It's a shallow, muddy, toxic. It's just not a one. So you start yelling at the fish, hey, the water is polluted. What's the fish going to say?
What's water?
And what's polluted?
Yeah.
Culture is the only thing we know. So a lot of times what businesses fail to take into account is, first of all, you already have cultures going through your gills. Second, you're hardly aware of them. In fact, most of the science says upwards of 95% of the cultures going through your gills, you're unaware of. You're not conscious of them. So imagine how it sounds when you say, now this morning, we're going to begin to instill cultures. We're going to engage our culture. And one colleague looks at the other and goes, what the hell is culture? Now, because they enjoy getting a paycheck, they're not going to say that. They're going to think it. And they're going to play the game. That's why, if you actually expose people and make them conscious of the cultures they swim in, you'd have to do what you'd have to do to a fish in the Anacostia to make them aware of they live by water going through their gills. How can you make a fish aware of that?
Take it out of the water,
which most fish really enjoy. They lay on that boat and just start taking in the sunshine and that. Soaking up the rays and saying, this is great, man. I love being out of that culture. Heck no. And that's why if you're skillful in how you make people aware of the cultures they swim in your company, it many times makes them really uncomfortable. Really uncomfortable. So we have to first begin by starting almost all over when we talk about cultures. We don't engage cultures. We hardly instill cultures. We don't create cultures. I mean, even continue with our analogy of the Anacostia. Oh, yeah, we can create cultures. We're going to take down a bunch of buckets of clear water and pour it in the river, what happens?
Clear water won't be so clear after a while.
It won't be clear real quickly. It's what's called it. It takes the filthy water. It might be slightly diluted, but the clear water will be what's called assimilated, such that you could talk to your blue in the face about some things, about values, but if they get assimilated into a society that is extra practical, they're going to dutifully take note still. This thing becomes practical. At which point it's now practically useless, because they're only going to be asking, how's this work? How's this work? It is, by the way, another example of a left brain world, because it is the left brain world. They say, you know, well, how can we make this work? How can we make this work? The left brain is the how and the what. The right brain is, why is it we even think that way? Where does this come from? What kind of world is this making right now? Lincoln, in his second, in his 1858 talk, when he began to address slavery issue, Lincoln said, we must first know where we came and where we are trending in order for us to know what to do and how to do it. We first have to know from where we came and where we are trending. He put it in slightly different words, but that's the gist of it. That's an ambidextrous way to think. You first have to locate yourself in history. That's what he was saying. If we're going to know what to do and how to do it. In a left brain world, we just want to know how to do it and what to do. And so they'll say, okay, well, here's how we're going to do it. We're going to instill four values here in the company. Now, a famous company that at one point made up 60% of the business of the case studies at Harvard Business School had a 65-page ethics manual on how to instill and cultivate these values. The name of the company was Enron.
Wow.
And everybody at Enron loved those values because they worked. It's fascinating to watch, by the way, that Enron, how its mission statement changed. It was started out as energy distribution, also like AES, similar rather. And then it was something along the lines of world's greatest energy company. And then just before it fell, it was world's greatest company. The hubris in that was never pushed back against by anyone, because everything was working. They were making fistful of money, or at least in the books it appeared that way. So there's an example of, an extreme example, I get it, but an example of not really understanding the cultures they swam in. And the cultures that they primarily swam in were hubris and greed. But no one would call it out because it risked your paycheck. It really takes an extraordinary company to invite outsiders to see what the insiders don't see. Extraordinary company. In fact, some of the research indicates only 0.1% of firms founded in the U.S. have that kind of outside-inside infrastructure that invites outsiders to see what insiders don't see. So in my work as an outsider, the several companies where I've suggested the values are not particularly a great way to go, it wasn't that well received. Maybe it was the way I presented it, but here's a different way to think of it. This past year, Gertrude Himmelfarb passed away. First of all, I mean, she was a great woman, so we're not making fun of her name, but you have to smile when you hear that name. You think, hey, that's what we're going to name our daughter, Gertrude and then Himmelfarb. Gertrude Himmelfarb was the one who wrote some scholarly articles on what happened in the 19th century, the 1800s, which in the 1800s, what came into full bloom was a philosophy called positivism. Now, there's a word you hear every day. What in heaven's name does positivism? See, you can't even say it. What does positivism mean?
Well, sounds like positive.
Yep. That's half of it.
I mean, my basic guess would be an overuse of things being positive.
Close. That's another topic for another day. That when I were in Flannery O'Connor's neighborhood, that's exactly what she said, but that's another topic for another day. Positivism came out of the view from some cultural historians who said societies go through three phases. The first was what might be called the religious or God phase. They attributed these good things to God. The second would be the technological. But the third was the positivist. The most positive development in a society is when it finally splits the two between what the real world's all about and this God talk, and puts God talk down in a box, a lower level, where you're not dealing with reality, you're just dealing with your perspective on things. The upper level, it deals with facts. The lower level deals with faith. The upper level deals with truth. The lower level deals with tastes. Quick example, Pat. So the upper level deals with 2 + 2 = to test this morning.
4.
Very good. That's not a matter of opinion. That's truth. The lower level deals with pizza. Which is the best type of pizza, Pat?
I would have to go with a buffalo chicken. That's truth, though.
Yeah. Wow, you are weird, man. It's not. It's caprese. But anyway, that's right. So the lower level is a matter of taste. There's no such thing as the one right pizza.
Sure.
So because of that, the upper level was about truth. The lower level is about values. A term introduced by the atheist Friedrich Nietzsche. Now, this is important on one level if you're a Christian, because this introduced positivism. You say, oh, Mike, come on, get practical. Where does positivism ever show up? I'll show you. First of all, Aldous Huxley, his uncle, John, gave the opening address at the first graduate institution in the United States, opened in 1876, Johns Hopkins University. Baltimore. Johns Hopkins University was founded on the idea of positivism. They invited Huxley, who is a positivist, to give the opening address. Now, Huxley understood that Americans at that time tended to divide the world into there are Christians, and then there's everyone else, Muslims, atheists. So Christians are right, atheists, Muslims are wrong, so on and so forth. And positivists said, you know, we have a problem because all our friends think that way, but we don't. We want to change the world and create a world like it that goes like this. That religion, Christian, Muslim, everyone, they're all on this bottom shelf. So they're not atheists. Well, what are they? We know. So Huxley introduced a new word to the American lexicon, agnostic. What does the word agnostic mean? It comes from the Greek.
unknowing. It's one where I don't firmly believe God doesn't exist. I don't firmly believe he does. I just don't know.
Yeah, that's right. I don't know. That's it. The word gnosis is knowledge. If you put an a in front of it, like if you put theist and put an a in front of it, you're an atheist. If you put, so you deny the existence of God. If you take the word knowledge and put an a in front of it, you have agnostic. An agnostic denies that all the swirl on the lower level, religion, what have you, is not dealing with knowledge, not truth. It's dealing with taste. The upper level deals with propositions about truth. The lower level deals with just your personal preferences. You like veggie, I like caprese, let's call the whole thing off. And in this world, the highest value on the lower level is, drum roll, because this is where it gets very practical, the highest value is tolerance. Pet, you like buffalo chicken. I like caprese. If we really love each other, we tolerate each other. But we're not dealing with truth, for crying out loud. And so because of that, the positivist introduced a world where all you can talk about in this is our values. Now, that's because in the world prior, when Christianity was on the level of truth, the Bible never talks about values. This is Gertrude Himmelfarb. It talks about virtues. Virtues require this connection to truth. And so if you're a virtuous person, that is, you tell the truth, you operate in good conscience, it's because you live under this sacred canopy of God in God's universe, and you are responsible to respond to him properly. Well, you take all that away, what are you left with? So Gertrude Himmelfarb is the one who talked about when we went from virtues to values. But values are more just on this sort of level plane here on earth. So you don't have any right for your values to impugn on my values. It created a world where one person can't say to the other, thou shalt not. Example. No, Pat. Caprese is the way to go. You shall not eat buffalo chicken. Which, by the way, I have to tell you, you really shouldn't be eating buffalo chicken. I don't know if that pizza's very good for you. Now, if you want to get extra practical and you're Christian, you say, I still don't get it. Here's why it's extra practical. Positivism takes this phrase. It makes this phrase sound like this. Pepperoni pizza is the way, the truth, and the life. No one comes to pepperoni pizza except through pepperoni pizza. That's called absurd. But when Christianity is reduced to the level of values, that's a lot like saying pepperoni pizza is the way, the truth, and the life. No one comes to pizza except through pepperoni. No one comes to God except through Jesus. How intolerant, how narrow. Shouldn't we be tolerant of all faiths? Now this, in the modern university, departments of theology, which were considered to be the queen science, they're at the center of the university, Harvard, Yale, they shaped those schools. They were dissolved into departments of religion. And a surefire way to be unemployable is to graduate with a degree in religion. Not very practical. And then eventually you had departments of comparative religion. We're just comparing different types of pizza. Oh, that's fascinating. You have pineapple ham. That's cool, man. That's cool. To say anything other than it's cool would make you judgmental. Now you can see why even judgmental then falls apart. Because when you go to the grocery store and you are picking out avocados, this is pre-COVID, by the way, you gently squeeze them a bit. You don't want to get a rock hard avocado. You want to get one that's got a little bit of give to it. You are making a judgment. And why are you doing that? Because you're dealing with truth, reality, the real world. Pick up an orange, and once I just really caved in, you go, whoa, that thing's rotted. I'm not going to buy that. You judgmental person. No, you're making a judgment. So you can see why we get into almost theater of the absurd when companies mean well, but they get into this whole realm of values and cultures. Because in a left brain world, you just yawn to go, I don't really care where this comes from. I don't really care. I just want it to work. And in fact, it hardly works. Because we're talking in a way that you don't talk when you go home and you're with your wife or your husband. You don't talk that way with your kids, with your spouse. You don't talk that way to your daughter. You know, now that's not a value we uphold here. You know, the little girl looks at you cross-eyed. So, well, how do you do it differently? Well, and by the way, this also fits in the whole realm of, you say, well, that's true. We don't talk about that. We talk about principles. Oh, good. Principles. Just like you talk to your wife that way, right? Principles.
Yeah, I've heard guiding tenets is another one.
There you go. Guiding tenets. Some listeners going, what? You guys rent part of your house? You have tenants? No. Tenets. Guiding tenets. A lot of this comes out of the Enlightenment. So does the word concepts. Concept, literally, it's a kissing cousin to the word conceit. It's claiming to know something you really don't have your hands on. It's just it's an abstraction. It's a concept. Principles in the same way. You know, Thomas Jefferson, the quintessential Enlightenment man, was in principle opposed to slavery. In fact, the first bill he ever introduced in the Virginia House of Burgesses was addressed to slavery. But what did he do, though? What did he practice?
Having slaves.
He had over 100 when he passed away. You see, for him, it wasn't practical not to have slaves. How in heaven's name do you run this plantation without slaves? So you can say, here's a principle I live by. I'm opposed to slavery. Yeah, but you got slaves. Well, it's not a practical principle. He wrote eloquently against debt. He was in principle opposed to debt. Familiar with his estate when he passed away?
I suspect he had a lot of debt.
Deeply in debt. Well, it's not practical. So you can see why principles, concepts. A simpler way, Pat, is to actually see if you can construct exercises where people draw pictures or they tell you a picture based on drawings that you show them. And they will, you've got to, in other words, get your team to where they're telling you what they imagine or they're drawing for you what they imagine without giving it much thought. So the first time that you draw a picture, first time, once you get good at it, it doesn't work this way, but the first time you begin to draw, the same way when you first time learn an instrument, learn how to paint, you're primarily using your right hemisphere. You're pulling from your imagination. And your imagination is what governs the way you mostly behave. And so you might say, So I'll try to think of some exercises we've done before. Well, the chief one we do is we give people a big pad of paper. You can do it in a small piece of paper, just do it around a table, but don't let one look at the other and say, draw a picture of what success looks like in this company. You have to do that very rapidly, because if you explain for more than 7 seconds, they're drifting into their left hemisphere and they're entertaining one question, primarily one question. That question is,
what is success?
No, what is Pat looking for? So a lot of facilitators wreck this by over explaining it. I want you to draw a picture. And I wanted to really, you know, what does it look like when people here are happy, when people are, so you're giving away the game.
Got it. You want the raw thought.
You want the raw thought. That's right. It's actually called the unedited thought. It's, for example, if you're in a crowded theater and I run and yell fire, you're not going, I wonder what Mike means there. I wonder what he's getting at. So you're going to, you have subconsciously, what's called non-consciously, you have a whole boatload of experiences that shape the way you imagine what all that means when I yell fire, and you don't even have to literally consciously think about it. It's the same way when someone says, oh, yeah, I'm really not part of this smartphone generation. And it's when they are 5 minutes from their house and they reach for their phone in their pocket and they go, oh, my God, it's not here. Oh, my God. And you're looking for some app somewhere that tells you, where's my smartphone? Yeah, you are non-consciously, it's become, you know, it's the new portable iron lung. You have trouble breathing if you don't know where it is. We actually, you know, the people have what's called, you know, phantom vibrations on their hip. Someone reaches for, I thought my phone was ringing. That's a bodily way that your body has been shaped by the cultures that you swim in. The panic or the phantom vibration, all those things. And then you could tell how cultures are shaped, because I was going out the other morning and got a mile away and go, oh, darn, I didn't bring a mask. And that's called, when you get to a point where you don't think twice about it, you got a mask dangling from your mirror or on your shift knob on your car, that's called, you're now enculturated. You don't go anywhere without a mask. Mm. And in fact, when I was standing in this long line, it's this restaurant that's trying to stay open by offering chocolate croissants, fresh baked at 8 a.m. And Kathy, my wife, goes, would you please, let's go get some croissants. Yes. So I'm standing out in a line with about 50 people, all 6 feet apart, and I'm the only one without a mask on. So how do I feel?
Oh, boy.
Oh, boy. That's what I mean by cultures. You hardly even think about it. So people, you know, subconsciously, who's the idiot back there?
I was going to say, I don't think they're tolerating you very well.
Yeah, you know, I'm pulling my shirt up over and I had a friend drop a mask off and I put it on. All of a sudden, I'm not socially accepted. They all look at me and I could tell under their mask, they're smiling. Their eyes are kind of lighting up, you know, oh, it's so good to see you. That's what you mean by cultures. And so you've got to design, you've got to know, first of all, Pat, going in, what problem are you trying to solve? And then, so without giving away too much of the exercises we do in our little consultancy, when they want to do strategic planning, the first thing I have them do is draw a picture of success. So the very first time I ever did this, the 16 executives from up and down the East Coast, they went in different parts of the building and came back with their picture and put it on the wall. And of course, the first thing that shows up is, first thing that becomes apparent when they look at these 16 drawings, hand-drawn.
Money.
They're wildly different.
Wow. That was too easy.
Yeah. Wild, what does that tell you when they're wildly different? Or they diverge in important ways or obvious ways, apparent ways? What is that telling you?
No, they all have a different understanding of success.
But they have six core principles. There you go. So see, Jefferson wasn't a bad person. He simply couldn't imagine, how do you have the life that I'm accustomed to? How do you afford it without slaves? I don't know. I'm opposed to slavery, but I don't know. How do you afford the life that you're accustomed to without taking on enormous debt? I don't know. I'm an agnostic. But I really value, it's a value, an important value for me, for people not to be in debt. So I would encourage your team to come back and draw pictures, and then to share the pictures. And you, more often than not, I'd almost say almost every time, the pictures have enough of a divergence that you can say, it's not apparent to me we're all on the same page regarding what we're trying to do here. You know, what would be success? And then there's a series of exercises you can take them through to come to an agreement on the, here is the drawing that depicts it. And by the way, I use drawings because that comes from some work years ago by a woman. It's called, her name escapes me at the moment, Betty, it'll come to us, but it's called Drawing on the Right Side of the Brain. That's actually, it's used by Pixar, Apple, it's used by all sorts of organizations. Because if you see pictures, you're not using your right brain. If you have to draw pictures, you're using your right brain. Especially in the initial pictures you draw, when you first begin to draw. And by the way, here's a fascinating study. Once you get the hang of drawing, like once you get the hang of most everything else, you begin to drift into your left hemisphere, which just deals with the familiar. So you say, oh yeah, I know how to draw. Just like, remember when you took driver's ed? Remember the first time you got behind the wheel?
Mm-hmm.
Remember the first time you drove down the street?
Yeah.
What did it feel like?
A combination of exhilarating and terrifying.
Yeah. And the first time I remember, well, do you remember the first time you got on the freeway?
I was just going to say, that's the more vivid memory for me.
Why is it terrifying?
Higher speeds, a lot more cars.
That's right. We're going at 55 freaking miles an hour. You think that way today, don't you?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. See, you went from your right, where everything you taste and touch and felt, it's all rushing in, these new experiences, and your right, you're trying to make sense of it all. Oh, my smokes. Do you see that stuff rushing by us? Once you're familiar with it, you're in your left hemisphere. Hey, honey, do you know you're doing 80 right now? Oh, yeah, okay. Yeah. Plane back, not a problem. Boring. Not very practical. Wish we were Germans with an Autobahn. Germans are super ultra practical. See, draw pictures, because that will stimulate the right hemisphere. And as you rightly noted, it will give away the game. They'll be unedited. And you're right. First time I did this with another company, their warehouse, one of the warehouse people drew a big yacht, Beyonce on the bow, Beyonce, and big dollar signs. That's right. Everybody laughed and had a good time. But there was also, you make a mental note. That's not why we exist. We're not opposed to big boats, Beyonce, and beach living. But that's not why we're here. And sure enough, you know, a year or two later, that person was gone. But they sort of self-select out, because right, they begin to see, oh, you're pretty serious about what's called shaping the existing culture's plural, that are here shaping. And there are all sorts of exercises you can do too, because if cultures are worn paths, very apparent in books like Jeremiah, then you literally, and it's fascinating that we call the way we think that our thoughts travel on neural pathways, fascinating that we use that language, then you literally, Pat, have to begin to hack out in a person's brain new neural pathways, which we know over time, for example, people who read voluminously have much deeper neural pathways. They have the, literally the physiology of their brain changes. The valleys they're seeing in the brain are much more defined and deeper. You actually shape and change the physiology of your brain. So the more you read, the more you can read. The same way, though, in listening. The more you listen, the more you can listen. And what happens is the old neural pathways just become overgrown with shrubs and trees, and the concrete cracks up, and because no one's driving on it anymore. It takes on average about 3 years to carve out these new neural pathways where it's non-conscious. So you'd have to have a three-year project in mind to hack out for the people on your team new neural pathways. And the best way to do that is through facilitating exercises that people do, not passing on lectures and three-point outlines and PowerPoint presentations and so on and so forth. So there's ways we can do that, and we might talk about that in a future podcast. That's actually where we try to spend a lot of our time in the work that we do, because it puts a tremendous onus on the leader to facilitate. It's far easier to give people three-point outlines, long talks, write up books of ethics. But that's a lazy way to go, because you're actually not changing. You're not making any impact on the Anacostia River. The river, the water is still the same water it was before. You've just sprinkled in a few more words that float like leaves in the autumn across the top of the water, and then they just kind of float away. But they really don't change the way people behave.
That's helpful. I've been hesitant to engage in some of these conversations that have been going on from more of an organizational level, and then obviously like leading my team through them myself. But the hesitation has been primarily because I feel like I've been a part of these in the past, and it's been just that. It's been, here's a bucket of water, let's throw it in. And so I don't care to engage, because I think it's likely going to be fruitless. And I like what you said there. It's almost like the conversation starts at the wrong point. Because if we're talking about creating a culture, we're likely going to fill a bucket full of water and toss it in. But if we start the conversation around shaping existing cultures, that's a very different paradigm.
Yes, it is. And you know, half of me doesn't want to discourage people from wanting to have healthy cultures. That's very much what we should be about. But the other half says, we got to come to grips with what's involved in that. There's a reason why, listen, there's a lot of American culture is politicized, but let's not throw the baby out with the bathwater. Keen minds in politics pay attention to, amongst many things, what's called attention spans. And they've watched attention spans over the last 40, 50 years shrink, and it's called soundbite. And so it's not without merit that they understand you have about 2.6 seconds if you're going to talk to people to actually have something that's memorable. So years ago for Lloyd Benson, this was a little more than 2.6 seconds, but to say to Dan Quayle, well, I knew John Kennedy, and you're no John Kennedy. Why do we remember that? It's called the soundbite. 67 years ago. Why do we remember that? So first of all, these lengthy talks on cultures are not memorable. But they're also, here's a way to understand what we're up against. So you have a team of how many people, Pat?
Currently it's just four.
Four, not just four, four people made in God's image. And you're five?
No, I'm number four.
You're one, four. Okay, and you are how old?
I am 30.
Okay, and everyone else, total up all the ages. Just take a rough guesstimate.
Oh, gosh. Total 150.
You have 150 years of Anacostia River water flow through gills. 150 years cumulatively. Now, here's where we close, and we can pick this up. I believe it was 1978, the Congress of the United States passed a law to clean up the environment, to help clean up the environment. It was called the Ethanol Act. I probably have the year wrong, but that's not what's important. Amongst other things, for the last 150 years, the Chesapeake Bay is becoming more and more polluted. It's choking. It's a giant saltwater estuary. It's not really a bay. That's why the water is brackish. But the water used to be so clear that you could scoop out oysters and just eat them. Oysters have an incredible power to clean gallons of water every day, an individual oyster. The oyster beds today in the Chesapeake Bay are 1% of what they were 150 years ago. Congress passes the Ethanol Act to clean up the air. The Ethanol Act, grow corn. Corn put in the, mixed in with gasoline. Here's the unintended consequence, the negative side effect. Corn is a crop with one of the highest runoffs. It's a stalk, whereas leafy that sit along the ground actually better absorbing water and fertilizer. So since the act, the Chesapeake Bay has become more polluted because of agricultural runoff. The Chesapeake Bay watershed is humongous. You go way down I-95 or 81 south, you're deep into Virginia, heading toward North Carolina, and it says you are now leaving the Chesapeake Bay watershed. You make a giant arc almost through West Virginia. In fact, you do up through Pennsylvania, and you are still in the Chesapeake Bay watershed, where there are tens and hundreds of thousands of farms, large and small. And those farmers do well by growing corn, because corn gained a boost with the Ethanol Act, became more profitable, 40% more arable land, farmland, put into corn. This is what it means by cultures shaping. To take on what you want to take on, you're taking on 150 years of understanding of culture, human beings, human nature, values, so on and so forth. And these have all been shaped by tens of thousands and hundreds of thousands of experiences in your team over 150 years cumulatively that trickles in and creates the water. It's called the Chesapeake Bay. And that's the culture you're in. I'm not saying the culture is polluted. I'm not saying that. I'm saying that's what you're dealing with, Pat. And it takes an extraordinary leader to understand the various contributing streams that create the language of, well, we're going to work on our values. And we're going to clarify our values. We're going to revisit our values. We're going to dig deeper into our values. We're going to strengthen our values. But you don't have anybody, rarely a company has anyone that comes in and says, an outsider who says, and you do this at home, right? With your spouse and family? Of course not. I would submit to you, your family's closer to understanding how human nature works than your business. And maybe we'll talk about that next time, because it has to do with when businesses were considered cottage industries. They came out of the home, and that changed some 200 years ago.